the state has resources in terms of fossil fuels in almost every different part of the state.
A new report catalogs carbon deposits and geothermal across the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 3 days after the big storm, some Anchorage residents are still in the dark.
We're still striving to have all the outages restored by this evening, though there will be some isolated outages that may carry over into the weekend.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home, and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Governor Sean Parnell has issued a disaster declaration for Kivalina. The declaration makes funds available to pay for expenses associated with emergency protective measures and immediate efforts to refill the community's water holding tanks. Last month's heavy rainfall in Kivalina resulted in record flows on the Woolock River, which washed away several sections of the surface water piping and prevented the city of Kivalina from filling the city's raw water tank. Alaskans can now look at what is believed to be every substantial energy source in the state. The Alaska Energy Authority and the Department of Natural Resources today released a 144-page study by the state's Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys that shows information currently available from across the state on sites containing usable quantities of fossil fuels and geothermal energy. It joins two other volumes published by the Energy Authority that show likely sources of renewable energy that could be used by communities. DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan said the publications are a tool for communities that now face very high energy costs.
Typically, as we've been looking in the state, we look to the North Slope in terms of Prudhoe Bay. We look to Cook Inlet, and those are very well-known hydrocarbon basins. But the state has resources in terms of fossil fuels in almost every different part of the state. And we think that what was very important is to be able to lay out where and what those resources are.
Sullivan says the information is part of what communities, native corporations, and regional planners will need for local development, calling it a book of possibilities, not answers. State geologist Bob Swenson said he was surprised by the data that showed considerable geothermal resources in the Aleutians and a very large coal deposit near Kotzebue. He said the best use of the report is to remove guesswork from plans.
This is not meant to replace anything. This is, if the best, most economic resource is a renewable, by all means, that is definitely what the community should go after and do. What's really important to make that analysis is to have the information, realistic information, for you to make the analysis.
Today's report will be combined online with the previous Energy Authority data. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. The Office of Management and Budget is keeping federal agencies in the dark for another week. OMB failed to issue a plan today, guiding virtually every department of the government on just how they should go about cutting their budgets. The report won't come until late next week. Those cuts are known as the sequester. As we've been hearing this week, sequestration would trim $1.2 trillion out of the federal government over the next decade. It was intended to force Congress to enact a long-term deficit reduction strategy. If Congress does not, on January 2nd, the government will begin trimming more than $100 billion immediately. The clock is ticking, and an election is nearing. All the while, the government and private sector can't plan for the future. APRN's Peter Granix explains how the sequester could affect the oil and gas industry in Alaska.
Little is known about sequestration other than this. The Pentagon will lose about $500 billion. The rest of the government will lose the rest. That's basically it. And it leaves the oil and gas industry in the dark. They have no clue what to expect. nor do environmentalists. And neither camp likes to envision what could be coming down the pike. The Department of Interior would not answer questions about sequestration, but the assumption is Interior, like other non-defense agencies, will have to trim between 8 and 10% of its budget. Most believe it will evenly hit everything: the EPA, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the National Park Service. Charles Clusen directs the Alaska program at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
I think we'll have less environmental protection. We'll have less meaningful management of wildlife from Fish and Wildlife Service. So I think with all these agencies, it's going to be a real problem where our important services that the public has come to expect that won't be there.
Clusen says he's worried a cut of 8 or 10% would lead to layoffs, from seasonal rangers in the national parks to the inspectors Interior Secretary Ken Salazar insists will be on scene in the Chukchi Sea. Just last week, Secretary Salazar approved Shell to begin operations in the Arctic.
Salazar and others have been promising they're going to have all these inspectors on all the ships and rigs and so on. And so if there were a real cutback of personnel, conceivably there won't be all those people watching.
But that cannot be verified until OMB releases its directive. Dan Kish is a longtime aide to former Senator Frank Murkowski and Representative Don Young. He's now with the Institute for Energy Research. He says layoffs at Interior could slow down the permitting process, and it shouldn't.
Unlike a lot of activities that the government does, these activities actually result in more money for the federal government. Issuing the leases for the Chukchi was over $2 billion for the federal government up front.
There are signs Congress will pass legislation delaying the sequester, but expect a showdown over budget cuts and taxes between now and the end of the year. A delay will not come easily, even if both parties support it. And if the cuts do come in January, either in full or part, pay attention. Both Clusen from the NRDC and Kish from the Institute for Energy Research talked about the Washington Monument Syndrome. It's fairly well known in D.C., and it means if the government shuts down, it shuts down the popular things first. People feel that. And then maybe, with even more pressure, this time from constituents, Congress might pass a deficit reduction package. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
About 400 municipal light and power customers in East Anchorage are still without power, according to spokeswoman Ronnie Dent. Dent said this morning that additional residences without electricity were located late last evening, many of them in apartments. She said power was being generated during the entire time, but it was the transmission system that was compromised due to so many trees hitting lines. MLNP has three transmission circuits that feed into distribution lines, but after the first went down, others followed suit within 20 minutes on Tuesday. Dent says the power company's goal is to get all customers back on by Saturday morning. Other power companies are not as close to restoring full service. Chugach Electric Association Communications Coordinator Sarah Wiggers.
Last night, our crews worked through the night, and we restored service to approximately 600 members last night. However, we still have approximately 2,000 that are without power. We have a total of 26 crews out in the field today. That's probably triple the amount of a normal crew that we would have out there.
Wigger says some customers may be without power for a few more days.
We're still striving to have all the outages restored by this evening, though there will be some isolated outages that may carry over into the weekend.
Chugach Electric serves more than 81,000 service locations in Anchorage.
And at the peak of the storm, we had 25,000 service locations out.
Most of those locations still without service are in the city's south and west sides. Anchorage city officials are not saying yet just how much the cleanup is costing the municipality after Tuesday's storm, or if the muni will request emergency status from the state. Don Brantley is Emergency Program Manager for the Anchorage Office of Emergency Management.
What I can tell you is that all that information is being pulled together and assessed, and we have spoken with the state. What would happen was would be that the mayor would have to declare an emergency for the city of Anchorage and then request help from the state. And so what they've been doing the last couple of days is pulling together what was the cost of the response to the city and to the different agencies. When did the emergency really start, and when was the severe weather alert canceled? And so we've been talking back and forth between departments and the weather service and the state. But that decision should be made shortly.
The city is still assessing the cost of damage in the aftermath of the storm. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, building community in ADAC.
You have Aleuts from all different areas working to make this come to life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
There's another plan to get natural gas to Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's one of several in play aimed at reducing Fairbanks' dependence on high-cost oil and air-polluting wood and coal.
Two projects to truck in North Slope natural gas are already in the works in Fairbanks. One involves a partnership of Golden Valley Electric and the Flint Hills Refinery. The other is being independently pursued by local private utility Fairbanks Natural Gas. Now comes a third proposal from the Lowell Group, a collection of retired local engineers, military, and politicians. Group spokesman, former Fairbanks Borough Assembly member Hank Bartos, says it addresses gas demand locally and in the broader region.
It covers the interior villages. It also covers LNG and propane to Fairbanks, and it all can be done within 2 years.
The Lowell Group proposal hinges on getting $319 million from the state to build a North Slope gas processing facility, storage tanks, trucks, barges, and local distribution piping to thousands of Fairbanks area homes. Bartos says the plan calls for the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and Fairbanks Natural Gas to carry out the project.
It'll be a loan through ADA to FNG, Fairbanks Natural Gas, our only gas utility in the interior. They'll be rate regulated. They'll operate the plant, which is owned by the state, and gas will be available to FNG, Flint Hills, and Golden Valley, and then the people of the interior.
Bartos says propane stripped from gas at the North Slope processing facility would be offloaded at the Yukon River Bridge on the Dalton Highway for barge shipment to communities along the river. The Lowell Group plan comes as another fourth gas-related proposal also seeks traction and state dollars. Two borough assembly members and Mayor Luke Hopkins are pushing for the borough to form a gas distribution utility. It requires getting utility authority from the cities of Fairbanks and North Pole, something both community city councils are looking into. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska Standalone Pipeline, or ASAP, project officials are not daunted by competing gas line plans nor reports of increased Cook Inlet gas resources, according to Dan Foskey, president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and ASAP's chief officer. Foskey addressed a Commonwealth North luncheon in Anchorage this week. He outlined the current standings of the ASAP project while looking forward to what Alaskans could expect in the next 12 months regarding an in-state built and operated gas line. Foskey's AGDC is charged with delivering a project plan to the state legislature, which defines a route for a gas line that could deliver natural gas to South Central Alaska and to Fairbanks by late 2015.
ASAP is a solid project plan designed to be compatible with other projects. I've stated this many times, the work that we're doing, if in the event that a larger project comes, we would simply become a spur line. Because a big project, regardless of where it ends or goes, if it goes to Valdez, if it comes down another route, you're going to need spur lines. The myth that the oil companies will not accept other people's work is simply not true. We're going to show you that when we outline how close we are to having the environmental impact statement.
Foskey says ASAP's final environmental impact statement is expected to be in the hands of the state by October 5th. He said that ASAP's approach takes the project in stages so as not to waste state money if the project is not feasible, and he reiterated that there is room for ASAP in the state's other plan for a large-capacity gas line.
The large LNG plan was being considered by ExxonMobil, BP, Conoco, TransCanada is due a quarter of 2012. Now, what the governor had done, he said, is the next step is for the producers and TransCanada to get to with AGDC, which is us, the corporation that we own as a people, as a subsidiary of Alaska Housing, to determine whether there is interest and value in merging and combining those efforts. Well, it's now the third quarter, and we anticipate that there will be some announcements by the end of the month.
Foskey declined to speculate on that announcement, except that it concerns a large LNG project. State spokeswoman Sharon Lehouse says that announcement would not come from the governor's office, but from the producers. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is holding its first ever stand-down outreach event in Southeast Alaska today and Saturday at Juneau Centennial Hall. Stand-down events are designed to provide services to veterans, especially homeless vets and vets in need. The Juneau event will feature information about VA services as well as 13 local nonprofits and Native groups. Marsha Hoffman DeVoe is a spokeswoman for the Alaska VA healthcare system.
Having, you know, VA staff and programs and community programs ultimately provides a better package, you know, for the veterans, so that, you know, we're working with the agencies here in the community to, you know, do those transitions between what we can provide and what the community agency can provide.
Hoffman DeVoe says VA stand-down events take place nationwide. Anchorage has hosted them for more than 25 years and Fairbanks for more than a decade. Barrow held the first one in rural Alaska last fall. She hopes the Southeast stand-down will become a regular event.
There are 77,000 veterans in the state of Alaska. I just checked the 2010 census figures again, and Alaska continues to have the highest number of veterans per capita. At 14% of our population is veterans. About 10% of those veterans live in Southeast Alaska.
In addition to healthcare and housing services, veterans who attend the event can get used clothing, blankets, and sheets through the U.S. Defense Reauthorization Office. The event will continue Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Centennial Hall, and lunch will be provided.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, Ghost Town. Until the late 90s, Adak was a bustling military base. It had a bowling alley, a movie theater, and housing for thousands. Now, with the Navy gone, the Aleutian town sits mostly empty. There's a chance Arctic drilling could turn it into a boom town, but right now, it feels like a collection of modern ruins. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez traveled to Adak to find out what it's like to live among them.
A couple years ago, the producer of the Blair Witch Project came to Adak to see about filming a zombie movie there. It's basically a pre-made set. There are abandoned buildings everywhere, and even just poking around the barracks, I got creeped out.
Gosh, this is just really spooky. There's broken glass everywhere. I wish I had a flashlight.
The hospital, the officers' clubs, a weapons facility known as the Seven Doors of Doom, that was all sold to the Aleut Corporation when the Navy decided to close its base in 1997. A small town grew up in its place. Cynthia Galaktionov first came to Adak in the 90s, and given the town's short history, she's an old-timer. Living in a place outsiders describe as a ghost town doesn't faze her anymore.
Well, we're used to it, I guess, but people do look at it that way because all these buildings are empty and they're kind of spooky and things, but we live with them and it's just part of our infrastructure.
While stuff like that is routine to her, some spots like the old Naval Exchange still make her wonder what Adak must have been like when it was at capacity.
There's a beauty salon in there with chairs and the mirrors and the whole thing. And you could just imagine all those baby wives coming in there and, during the 70s, getting their poofy hair done. It's easy to do here. It's easy to imagine what it must have been like.
Life was probably more convenient for those Navy wives than it is for Adak's current residents. Without the federal government shipping supplies out to the Bering Sea Island anymore, household goods are expensive. $10 will buy you a box of Cheerios. On top of that, much of the military infrastructure is rotting away. Power doesn't run to any of the old gyms, and the school's Olympic-sized pool goes unheated. Even so, Cynthia speaks lovingly of Adak. Nobody was born there, and everyone who lives there chose to. Over a plate of meatloaf, she tells me that's created a tight-knit community.
It hits you after a while because things just become, homey to you, and you're relaxed and easy around them, and we all care for each other a lot, and we're all in the same boat. I mean, what happens to one happens to all of us.
I get what Cynthia means while riding in Mary Nelson's truck the next day.
Hey, what? Yeah, I'm going to be there for the picture.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for reminding me.
Mary just finished her morning shift as secretary of ACDC. Not the rock band, but the Adak Community Development Corporation. Her lunch hour is blocked out for a community photo in support of a sick resident, but she's got some time to show me the McDonald's restaurant, or the Mount Moffat Cafe, as it's now called.
It's a stiff door.
Like everything else, the fast food joint was abandoned when the Navy pulled out. But ACDC fixed it up and turned it into a galley for the town's one seafood processing plant. Mount Moffat Cafe still looks like any McDonald's across the country. There are golden arches on the doors, and there's a drive-through sign out back advertising Jurassic Park movie tie-ins. Mary's happy to have people in there again. It's a sign that Adak is coming into its own.
We're pioneers. In 2001, the military released it to the Elliott Corporation, and a city was born, a second-class city, and it's only gone up from there.
Adak's continued development is based on its ports infrastructure. Fishing boats deliver cod there regularly, and now the oil industry is looking to use Adak as a hub for Arctic drilling. Elaine Smiloff is a harbor master, and she'll be overseeing that rise in vessel traffic. She's originally from the lost village of Unga in the Eastern Aleutians, and she moved to Adak in 2004.
I came out, the Aleut Corporation had a program for the shareholders to come out and pick a house. And I thought, well, I'm going to at least go look. And I just fell in love with the place because it felt like home.
Elaine is optimistic about Adak's future. As an Aleut, she especially wants to see Adak succeed. Aleut Corporation shareholders make up about a quarter of the population, and Elaine thinks that the town's potential could attract others down the road.
To me, Adak is the economic future for the Aleuts. That you have a lot of villages that aren't doing well. That's what's neat about Adak, too, is you have Aleuts from all different areas working to make this come to life.
Someday, she hopes, Adak won't be known as a ghost town anymore. In Adak, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Today, for 300 Villages, we're heading to King Salmon and Naknek, communities separated by a 16-mile road. They're located at the start of the Alaska Peninsula and a gateway to Katmai National Park.
My name is Trista Blizzard. I live in King Salmon, Alaska, Naknek, Alaska. It's the Bristol Bay Borough, and I'm with the Chamber of Commerce. What you're looking at is a fishing town. It's got more than 15 canneries along the river now. I mean, that's what really makes our community survive for the winter. I mean, we have a good two to three weeks of strong fishing where we have fishermen out on hundreds of boats out on the river. and we have locals as well as maybe the population here grows by 10,000 people in the summertime just from people coming in to fish or work in the canneries. There's a couple craft groups. There's a lot of crafting, a lot of artisans in the community. There's bazaars that go on that celebrate those. And they're fairly large and really popular. Got to keep in mind, we don't have a lot of shopping to do here. And so those are just a blast when they do happen. Yeah, high school sports are a large focus of the community. The kids are a large focus. The mental well-being of the long winter months are a big focus, and coming together, finding many community events, potlucks, and like I said, the craft, and just celebration of community. I can't say enough about how much we're struggling here. Old families are having to leave. You can't afford health care out here. You can't afford to heat your home for the winter. You can't even afford to keep your privately owned fishing permit. There's people who are trying to get out of here. There's people who are getting out of here. And our school is losing students. Like, it's a really fast rate. I expect in about 5 years, I heard an estimate of 50 students will be lost. I think the state of rural Alaska, it's in a desperate situation, and we strongly need some assistance, and we need somebody to pay attention to our needs.
Trista Blizzard works for the Chamber of Commerce in King Salmon. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Alexandra Gutierrez and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports, faa.gov/go/flyalaska, or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Back injuries have little to do with the weight of an object, but everything to do with how it is lifted. Remember, 1, move close to the object, 2, bend your knees, and 3, lift with your legs. Employers for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.